Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. This week, artists say PRS fees could cause live stream losses. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we are going to be taking a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. A week when Taylor Swift released her second surprise album of 2020.
She did. And I have nothing to say about it. Have you listened to it? Because as we record this podcast, it hasn't actually been out that long, has it?
Yes, but I have listened to it. I listened to it first thing this morning.
Well done.
And I was worried it was going to be rubbish, but it's not. It's good. It's got more swearing on it, this one.
Remind me what it's called?
Evermore.
Evermore, that's right. I knew it rhymed with folklore, but I couldn't quite remember what it was. Because although it is her second surprise album of the year, it is almost part two to the first surprise album of the year.
Yes.
Folklore that came out in the summer.
Yes, it's the same collaborators with a couple of extra ones. So as well as Aaron Dessner from The National, she also has a track with Matt Berninger from The National. Justin Vernon from Bon Iver is back again, as is Jack Antonoff, and this time Haim are on there too. So some extra collaborators, but pretty much like the same core team as Folklore. And I mean, she said she just, you know, they made Folklore and she just didn't want to stop. So they carried on working together and they've made another album and it's still good. And yeah, it's a lot more sweary. She swore for the first time in the history of her songwriting on Folklore, and now she seems to be really running with it.
Well, that's lovely, I'm sure, for anybody in the intersection of the Venn diagram between Taylor Swift fans and swearing fans. Don't know how many people there are in that little intersection of the Venn diagram, but good news for all of them. And of course, she's brought out this second surprise album, despite also being busy re-recording all her old albums.
Where does she find the time?
Well, I guess she's not touring. I guess that's the point. Get her back on the road and all of this over-the-top productivity with new recordings and re-recordings will end, I assume. But yeah, I suppose, well, that'll be an interesting thing to do come March. Let's hope. I mean, the vaccination's out there now, isn't it? So I'm told. Let's hope that by March, even if it then takes 12 months, to get back to normal, that come March, we start to see the end of the COVID tunnel. And maybe them, bearing in mind, we'll then basically have had a year of not complete lockdown, but I mean, for most musicians, basically a year of shutdown. Maybe we could do a chart of who were the most productive artists when they had that downtime and they weren't out touring and they weren't out partying. Who put that 12 months to the best use? We'll do some research on that, but Taylor Swift could be coming quite high on that list.
She certainly could. She has done a lot in a year where no one was really doing anything.
Talking of looking back over the last year, which I wasn't really, but I am now.
Yep.
This is the final set list of 2020.
It is.
We are taking a Christmas holiday this year, which I don't think we've done for the last few years, because we have a Taylor Swift level work ethic, just not at the moment. We usually do. You might be thinking, oh, final set list of the year, that's going to be a review of the year podcast, but you'll be wrong, it's not. Although I think in the final section you are going to do a sort of a review of the songs you like this year, so not a review of the business year.
No, I think that anything that would be discussed in a review of the music business year podcast is stuff we've talked about a lot and people probably don't want to hear us talk about yet again.
Of course, if you were a conscientious podcast editor, you might go back through the archives and you could put together a sort of a clips edition for Christmas. But you're busy. You've not got time for that. So let's not promise that. Let's just tell people...
This already takes long enough.
...that in the final section of this edition of Setlist, we're not going to be doing a review of the music business year, but you are going to be telling us about your favourite tracks of 2020. So that's coming up on this edition of Setlist. I've kind of ruined your intro because I know you like to sort of say what's coming up, but we're not talking about that first. We're definitely not talking about Taylor Swift's new album for 20 minutes because I've not listened to it. So what are we talking about for the main section of this edition of Setlist?
Well, as I said right up at the top of the show, artists are saying that PRS fees could make their live streams loss makers. And we know that because last week, the UK's Music Managers Forum and the Featured Artists Coalition hit out at Songwrites Collecting Society PRS for Music over its proposed royalty rates for live streamed shows. Those two trade groups argued that there is a staggering disconnect between the rate for real-world live shows and the proposed rate for online gigs, and that the proposed rate has been determined without consultation of the wider music community.
Yeah, and this all relates to something that I think we did talk about on an edition of Setlist earlier in the year, when it first became clear that lots of artists were going to use lockdown and shutdown to start live streaming shows, initially from their kitchen and their bedrooms, giving it away for free. But then subsequently, a lot of artists have been doing ticketed live streams, usually with much higher production values, often recorded at a venue. And we talked about at the time, what does that mean from a rights perspective? And that's what this debate that has been going on behind the scenes pretty much ever since we talked about that on Setlist, and has now gone public because of the statement that was put out by MMF and FAC just over a week ago. So live streaming is interesting. It's interesting for a number of different reasons. First of all, you could wonder why it is in 2020, the music industry, whether that's promoters or agents or artists or managers or labels or publishers or collecting societies like PRS, why are we only now having a conversation about how we structure live concert streaming from a business perspective? Because, I mean, at the end of the day, I think I was pitched the first concert streaming platform by a startup, I would say, in the first year that CMU existed. So that's 1998. So more than 20 years ago, people were talking about live concert streaming. So there have been plenty of opportunities over the last 20 years to say, okay, if concert streaming is going to be a thing, how do we structure it in terms of which of an artist's business partners are going to get involved and which copyrights and what elements of copyright are being exploited? It's just that until this year, nobody really paid that much attention to concert streaming. So nobody's ever worked out how we should commercialize it. But as I say, live streaming is interesting. And the main reason it is interesting is because the music industry, as we know, has lots of different strands to it. Because artists have different business partnerships with different business partners for each of their revenue streams. So therefore, you can split the music industry up into the record industry, the publishing sector, the live industry, the merchandise business, the director fan strand. These are all separate bits of the industry with different people, different companies. Artists work with all of them, but each of those business partners only get involved in one aspect of the artist's career, one aspect of the artist's business. But something like live concert streaming arguably brings all the strands together because it's a live show. So it's part of the live business, but it's also recorded content. So it's part of the record industry. Meanwhile, songs are being performed and exploited. So therefore, that's publishing. And a lot of these live streams have been selling merchandise around the live streams. It's part of merch. The director fan relationship is really important in terms of selling tickets. So it's director fan. So all these different strands of the business are coming together. And then from a copyright perspective, well, the way the music industry licenses live music, because obviously publishers and songwriters, usually through the collective licensing system like PRS, are paid when songs are performed live, because that is exploiting the performing rights of the copyright. But the way that is handled for live music and the way digital is licensed is very different. So now that finally concert streaming is coming of age and being commercialized, we have these two really important questions. Of all the artist business partners, who's getting involved? And when it comes to the copyright questions, are we going to treat a live stream as a live show or a stream? Because that will have a big impact on how it is licensed. And I guess it is all about, we have another digital pie to slice up here. We've got the live streaming digital pie. We all know that when it comes to slicing up pies, the music industry often falls out. And that's the big question is, how are we going to slice up this pie? And the problem is with live streaming, there are so many business partners who could potentially get involved, could potentially insist that they have to be involved. It could be that between them, they all want 150% of the money. And there isn't 150% of the money. So I guess this is the challenge that is going on behind the scenes in the music industry at the moment is, now we think that live concert streaming is going to become a long-term revenue stream, not just something that happens during COVID. It's a long-term new revenue stream. How are we going to commercialize it? How are we going to organize it? which business partners are getting involved, and what's happening on the copyright side. That's been happening behind the scenes for months now. It's now gone public.
So this particular debate that arose last week is all about how much of that pie the songwriters and publishers get. And as you say, that all comes down to whether we treat a live stream as a gig or just as a stream. Because for ticketed shows in the UK, the main PRS license charges about 4% of gross ticket sales. With on-demand streaming, the societies and publishers together usually get between 12 and 15% of whatever advertising or subscription monies are allocated to their repertoires based on the total consumption share. Now, for live streams, PRS is proposing something more in line with streams rather than gigs, which would charge 8% on the first £50,000 worth of ticket sales, but the percentage share would then increase on each additional £50,000 of revenue. So, for example, on ticket sales above £450,000, the rate would be 17%. And the plan is also to charge these rates retrospectively for live stream shows that have taken place in the UK over the course of this year.
Now, an added complication when it comes to the song rights with live streaming, beyond are we going to license it like a live show or are we going to license it like a stream, there's also a copyright technicality here, which is when you have a live performance in a venue, only the performing rights of the copyright are being exploited. But with digital, usually we would say that the performing rights are being exploited on a stream, but so are the so-called mechanical rights, another element of the copyright. And when it comes to publishing, particularly here in the UK, actually, that's another important distinction, because PRS itself controls the performing rights. So when it's the performing rights being licensed, PRS certainly has to be involved and often takes the lead. But actually, publishers control the mechanical rights. So if we are treating this like a stream, then it's like, well, does that mean we're saying mechanical rights are involved here, and therefore some of this money will have to go to publishers through MCPS, the Mechanical Rights Collecting Society? And there was a bit of a debate earlier in the year saying, well, that probably depends on whether or not there is any pre-recorded material or post-show on-demand material associated with the show. So some people were saying, if it is truly a live stream and you can only watch it live, then even though, obviously, you could say there is some copying going on because the digital recording's got to get to the user's device, some people were saying, I think that's a performance. It's kind of like a TV broadcast, and we would usually say that that's a communication to the public or a performance, maybe a combination of the two. But I think most people would say, but if there's any pre-record, and some of the big live stream shows recently, they have included some pre-recorded content, or indeed they've pre-recorded the entire gig and then just put it out at a certain time, or if highlights of the show are available after the event on demand, then that's definitely copying going on there. That's the mechanical rights. So therefore, publishers need to be involved. Now, as far as we're aware, it has to be said that a lot of what we know about this license is what MMF and FAC published when they criticized it, because PRS hasn't put out many public statements about this. But as far as we're aware, the publishers are very much part of this conversation, and this license will include mechanical rights. So even if you have pre-recorded content or you have post-event content, this license will still cover you, because it's not just the performing rights, the mechanical rights are included. So that is a good thing. But what MMF and FAC are saying, bearing in mind that among their membership are a whole load of artists who have done some very significant ticketed live streams this year, often with their managers taking a key role in delivering those shows, what FAC and the MMF are saying is that whatever it is that we're getting under this license, 8 to 17% is way too high. And in their opinion, unless there's lots of sophisticated on-demand subscription stuff going on post-show, which could be licensed separately, fundamentally, their position is this should be treated more like a live show than a stream. Yes, we need to make sure the mechanical rights are covered if that's what we need, but the rate should be closer to the 4% that you would pay on a ticketed show than the 8% or maybe as high as 17% that PRS is proposing with this pilot license for live streaming.
Yeah, so in an open letter to PRS boss Andrea Martin, the MMF and FAC raised a number of issues with the proposed rate, saying, I mean, top line is they were saying that the proposed rate is unworkable. And they added that applying it retrospectively will result in past shows that were, I mean, in many cases, were put on to provide income for crews who were not touring, actually ended up making a loss for those people and the artists who performed them. And even coming out of the pandemic, it could stop the long-term potential of live streaming from being realised. It would not grow to become the new revenue stream that everyone has been expecting it to be. So the letter begins, PRS's proposed experimental tariff for live stream events is unworkable for artists. A starting rate of 8% of gross ticket receipts, rising to 17% of gross ticket receipts, will make live streaming unviable for both the smallest emerging artists and the biggest superstar acts. By comparison, the PRS tariff for a live in-person concert is 4 to 4.2% of gross ticket receipts. This is a staggering disconnect. A ticket is a ticket. Even worse, it goes on, these seemingly arbitrary terms have been determined without consultation and with an intention that they be applied retrospectively, a decision that will add to the grave financial distress facing artists and their wider teams, especially in the midst of a pandemic. Everyone agrees that songwriters must be compensated and live streams licensed properly. Indeed, the vast majority of our members are songwriters or their representatives. But in a year when live shows have effectively shut down and with more uncertainty ahead, live streaming has presented artists with one of their few opportunities to perform and connect with their fans. Later on, it says that charging artists up to four times their live rate strangles rather than nurtures the innovation that live streams have brought forth during the pandemic. And so MMF and FAC are asking PRS to reconsider its approach and engage with them in a full and transparent consultation.
Yeah, part of the frustration was this feeling, certainly from MFFAC, that there wasn't enough consultation before. I mean, this is still a proposed rate, but that the proposed rate was presented before any discussion took place. And I think what MMF and FAC are saying is, if you'd spoken with our wider membership and, you know, the managers of the big artists who've done the really big live stream shows, but also the managers of the more grassroots artists, if you'd spoken to everybody, then you would have potentially realized that, well, I think maybe there's this feeling that live stream shows are easy money because you don't have the costs of running the venue with an audience, and you can have a much bigger capacity for a live stream show than you can for, well, certainly a theatre venue. And so therefore, surely you're in the money. And it's interesting, in the statements put out by MMF and FAC, they were explaining how actually quite a lot of the big live stream shows that have happened over the summer, there were some significant costs. Because, yes, although you don't have to run the venue in terms of having an audience, you have to run the venue in terms of getting the band in. And obviously, the costs of production are higher because you've got to film it and you've got to record it. And there's been a real effort by a lot of artists, particularly in more recent months, to try and have really high production values on these shows. And so basically what they're saying is, we don't think that PRS has completely appreciated the costs of putting on these shows. And therefore, they are over assuming the profitability of those shows. And as you said, there is a risk that with the rate at the proposed level, that shows that have already happened could end up being loss-making because the royalty rate is so much higher than the people were expecting. And yeah, looking ahead into 2021, everyone is hoping that this is going to be a permanent new revenue stream. But what the managers are saying is, we need to find a workable rate on the songwriter side to make sure that we can make that happen long-term. And then, yes, looking ahead to 2021, there is this debate about, if the rate stands as it currently is, will it stop the potential of live streaming becoming a permanent new revenue stream for artists? Could it stop that from happening? And again, you know, it is worth stressing, and it's always kind of interesting, isn't it, in this scenario, that most of the artists from FAC who signed the letter, and most of the artists represented by the managers who signed the letter, are songwriters as well as artists. So, you know, a chunk of the money that will be coming through this royalty ultimately will go to the songwriter, except that There'll be a PRS commission to pay on that money. The money will take a while to work its way through the system. And if the publishers are getting a mechanical right cut, then more of the money might go to the publisher. So everyone wants to make this work, clearly, but definite frustration from the MMF and the FAC on the proposed rates from PRS and the process they went through to reach those rates.
So this open letter is co-signed by various people, 50 managers who between them represent a whole load of artists, including Dua Lipa, who recently put on a very high profile live stream with big production values and lots of guests. There's Liam Gallagher, who's done his live stream floating down the Thames, although that was, as you mentioned, a pre-recorded show that was put out as at a specific time. Also Gorillaz, who by the time this podcast goes out will have just done 3 live streams over the course of the weekend, plus artists like Biffy Clyro, Bicep, Fontaines DC, Youngblood and Arlo Park. And also artists themselves have signed it, so FAC members including Radiohead's Ed O'Brien, Aluna Francis, Graham Park, Dave Rowntree, Sandy Shaw and Simone Butler. So lots of big names represented in this letter protesting these rates. Now, PRS has responded. It said, PRS for Music members, alongside many others in our sector, have been very badly impacted by the shutdown of live music this year. We welcome the many initiatives to move live concerts online, and PRS for Music has designed an online live concert license which will allow the necessary rights to be licensed. The proposed pilot license scheme is still evolving. As conversations with our partners are active and ongoing, it would not be right for us to provide further detail or comment at this stage while we await their assessment and feedback. Of course, our primary role is to protect our members' rights and to ensure they are paid fairly for their work, which is more important than ever now. We hope that these conversations will progress quickly.
So we will see if those conversations progress quickly. There is a couple of extra complications for fans of complications in all of this. First of all, when it comes to PRS licensing these shows, obviously when PRS licenses gigs, it only licenses gigs in the UK. But a live stream is basically global, isn't it? I mean, unless you did some pretty full-on geo-blocking, people are going to be tuning in from all over the world. Now, PRS thinks that it's able to offer a global license, which is really what we need in this scenario. Although I've heard a little bit of gossip that maybe some other collective societies around the world have a different opinion on that. So that's another complication. And then as the debate around how we organise and structure live streaming continues into 2021, how do we make this a permanent new revenue stream for artists? Which business partners do we involve? What rights do we involve? There's a whole extra debate to be had that has nothing to do with PRS in all of this, which is the minute we admit that there's a recording going on with these live streams, and let's say if there's a pre-record or post-event content, there's definitely recording going on. Still of debate if it's a truly live stream, but the minute there's a recording going on, if you are signed to a record company as an artist with a classic record deal, the label has exclusive rights over your recordings. So now we need to cut the label in. And I think I sense that during the pandemic, given that we all know that the record industry actually has been much more immune to the impact of the pandemic than everyone else in the music industry, the labels have been a little bit more relaxed on this than they might normally be, although some of the labels certainly see that maybe live streaming is a business that they should be getting into, and some labels are dabbling in that space. But yeah, there'll be a whole extra person at the table getting increasingly vocal next year, I think, if it turns out that live streaming has a life beyond the COVID shutdown, also demanding involvement. So for fans of squabbling between different strands of the music industry, I think this will deliver in 2021. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe everyone will come up with a workable model and everyone can make these live shows happen and get their fair cut of the pie. We will see.
And finally, as we approach the end of the year, it is traditional at CMU for us to put together some playlists of our favourite music of the year. And this year, well, we've done it again because, you know, why ruin a winning formula? But the formula basically is that in the CMU Daily, if you're not a CMU Daily reader, which you should be, twice a week, we pick a new artist to write about, so Tuesdays and Thursdays. And then for the last 4 of those slots in the year, we release a 40-track playlist in 4 parts. So 10 at a time. The tracks are basically in chronological order as they were released across the year, and we split them up into seasons because That's nice, isn't it? And so as you hear this, assuming you're listening on Monday as it goes out, which, I mean, why wouldn't you? There are still two parts of this playlist to go, so you're going to get a little preview of what's to come. And maybe even, I don't know, I've I've been tinkering with and changing these playlists right up to the last minute, so hopefully I won't say anything that subsequently gets cut. But shall we talk about some of the very best music of this year? Because it has been a very good year for music, despite everything.
Yeah, you might be thinking, well, wouldn't it be nice if, as part of this, at the end of set list, they played some of these tracks and we had some music on this edition. But hey, if you think licensing live streams is a nightmare, you take a look at what it involves licensing music for podcasts. So we're not going to do that. But as the podcast goes out, the first half of this playlist is already available to stream on Spotify, and we'll put the link in the notes to the podcast, and then the other half will go live this coming week. But yeah, why don't you just quickly tell our listeners what artists, what tracks they can expect to hear in our retrospective playlist of 2020.
Well, I'm not going to go through all 40, but I'll pick up some highlights. So Rina Sawayama was an artist we were very excited about this year. We thought she was a shoo-in for the Mercury Prize, but then it turned out she wasn't eligible for it, which was a controversy in itself. But her album was excellent, and we've picked one of the best tracks off it, Comme des Garçons. I'm not going to try a French accent again. And I didn't try it then. Who else we got? We've got Dua Lipa, who was sort of the hero of lockdown when she was one of the first big artists to release an album in the midst of lockdown. And while I think there were a lot of fears from artists and the people they work with that doing that could turn out to be a bad thing, for her, it really worked. And obviously it helps that it's a really good album. Who else have we got in there? Nadine Shah put out a brilliant album this year. Eve Tumor, Charlie XCX was the other lockdown hero. She, as I'm sure you'll remember, at the beginning of lockdown, set herself a 6-week deadline to make a whole new album, made very much in the moment. And with a great deal of transparency, she involved her fans in the whole creative process of making that album. And when she first announced that project, it seemed like we might be out of lockdown by the time she released it. But obviously, that was because at the time, no one thought, well, this is going to take longer than 6 weeks. But it did. But that album was another big success of the pandemic, if that's a thing you can say. It's very much going to be linked to 2020 and the pandemic forevermore. Although I think it's an album that definitely stands out on its own. And it's not like it's about a pandemic. It's an album that will have a life beyond this. Two other artists who released, I think, probably some of their best albums, if not their best albums this year, Fiona Apple and Ghost Poet. Very different albums, but both excellent and kind of shouldn't be pulled apart and put on a playlist. You need to go and listen to those albums in full. I'll get into the bits of the playlist that we haven't yet revealed. So in our summer playlist, we got, there's a Juice WRLD track, which I don't know. I'm the nerd about including that because although actually I think his posthumous album has some really good stuff on it, I think some of the collaborations don't necessarily work that well, but some of the stuff that was just him on his own really highlights what a great artist he was and what a great loss he was when he died. But the reason I said I wasn't sure about including it is because also his lyrics really kind of, I mean, this is true across his work, kind of foreshadow his death and can make listening to him quite uncomfortable at times, but I still think we had to have him in there because he was a great artist who is sadly missed. We mentioned Taylor Swift at the top of the show. We've got a track from Folklore in there because that's another album that obviously is very much a 2020 record and is also some of her, you know, career best work. Obviously, she's just released this second surprise album, Evermore, which I still need to spend some time getting to know, but Folklore I've listened to a lot this year. Taylor Swift was one of my top five most listened to artists this year, and that was pretty much exclusively that album that got her there. The artist I think, though, who I most listened to this year, and this was listening to their entire catalogue because I'm a very big fan, but Deftones also put out a really great new album. It's always exciting when they come back with an album and it's good. And this, but this one was, I think, was particularly good in the context of their wider catalogue, and I've listened to it a lot. That's the album Ohms. Who else have we got? Kelly Lee Owens put out her second album, another great album. Big Sean, Everything. I mean, I could sit here and list all 40 tracks, but you're going to have to go and listen to them all. It's a great playlist. I've been listening to it a lot. I think that you will enjoy it too. It's very varied. It's got a lot of different stuff in there. I've tried to cover a lot of different genres along the way with this, rather than just focusing on maybe the big releases.
So lots of tracks to be checking out. And that is not the full list, because there's 40 of them. So as we say, half of that is already available on Spotify as this podcast goes out. Within a week, the other half will be available. If you check the notes for this podcast, there's a link there, or sign up to See Me Daily if you're not a See Me Daily subscriber, and you can get more information in there as well. But yeah, that's it for this edition of Setlist, last Setlist of 2020. So I guess from me and the wider CMU team, Andy can say it himself in a minute. I'm not saying Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year on Andy's behalf. He can do that himself. But I will say it for me and the CMU team. And yeah, have as good a Christmas as you can in the circumstances. And we will be back with more Setlist, more CMU Daily, more... Oh, we got so much CMU stuff happening in the first few months of 2021. We'd need a whole 30-minute podcast if I was to begin to tell you some of the webinars and events and reports and research that we've got all coming to fruition in early 2021. But keep an eye on CMU Daily, and we will definitely keep you up to date with that.
So Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year to all you listeners. But as Chris says, that is the end of this edition of Setlist. And that is all from Setlist in 2020. We will be back in 2021. And to be prepared for that, why not hit the subscribe button if you haven't before, and also rate and review and tell all your friends about us so that everyone can be ready for our big return in 2021. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Moulton, Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.